Our final case of the morning is United States against Kelly. Mr. Flynn.
May it please the court, my name is Jerry Flynn. I represent Lamon Kelly. I would first like to address whether Mr. Kelly's due process rights were violated by the court's admission over his objection to the out-of-court statements of two witnesses who failed to testify and were not subject to cross-examination. In order to fully explore this argument, I think you need to immediately go to Morrissey v. Brewer, where the United States Supreme Court held that, among other things, that a defendant has a due process right to confront and cross-examine adverse witnesses at a revocation hearing. And this is coming right from the opinion, unless the hearing officer specifically finds good cause for not allowing confrontation. To counsel's knowledge, that specific holding has never been overruled by the United States Supreme Court. The counsel would acknowledge that the district courts have, and in particular the Seventh Circuit, has eliminated the need for a finding of good cause. But to the extent that there have been previous appellate court opinions that have not required a specific finding of good cause, Mr. Kelly would assert that those cases have been decided incorrectly. Because, quite frankly, the Supreme Court holding is clear. With regard to determining whether there is good cause to prohibit or to not require cross-examination, one of the things...
What difference does any of this make given the large number of violations to which your client is admitted?
Well, Your Honor, I would concede that the district court could have eliminated the possibility of an appeal because of his absolute discretion in sentencing if he would have said, regardless of my finding on these grade A violations, I still would have sentenced Mr. Kelly to 24 months imprisonment. He did not do that. As a consequence, the district court proceeded after Mr. Kelly acknowledged and admitted to the grade B and grade C violations, proceeded to allow evidence to be presented on the two remaining grade A violations, made findings of fact on those issues, and again was silent on whether he would have sentenced to 24 months regardless. So that is why it is relevant, and that's why we are here. The district court could have eliminated this appeal if it would have said I would have sentenced to 24 months regardless. Reliability, the primary method of establishing reliability has been corroboration. What evidence corroborates the hearsay? And in order to, the government cited a series of cases, and I would assert without question that almost every one of those cases has substantially more corroboration of the hearsay than in this particular case. And in looking at the facts of this case, we had a situation where an unidentified caller called the police, and according to the testimony of the officer, there was a man with a gun at a certain address. Now, his report, as you'll see in the addendum, does not say this. He says he responded to a suspicious activity. But the police officer did testify that he responded to a 911 call that reported a man with a gun at a specific address. He arrived. He observed two alleged victims, one of whom had obvious injuries to his face. They told the police officer, according to the officer's testimony and report, that he had that my client, Mr. Kelly, had brandished a gun. The gun was ultimately found by the police officer in the trunk of Mr. Kelly's car. The problem is that the police officer could not access the trunk immediately. He had to take the truck or the vehicle to the police station, and then he had to access the trunk with a screwdriver. There's no mention by any of the two alleged victims that Mr. Kelly had in any way tampered with the trunk. The government's brief, although the record is silent on this.
Would there have been any problem at this hearing in your client calling the declarants to the stand and getting their live testimony?
The burden of proof remains with the government. And the burden of proof is...
Would you answer my question? Would there have been any problem in calling them to the stand?
There would not, if they could have been found.
That's one of the questions. Would there have been a problem? Did you try to find them and be unable to find them? Is that where the problem is?
Well, I rested on the well-established principle that the burden of proof rests with the government.
Is it safe to infer, therefore, that you did not try to find them?
That would be a safe assumption, although the record is silent on that. And I again would assert that the burden of proof rests with the government.
That's fine. One can say that.
The law establishes that, Your Honor, respectfully. I mean, I know of no case.
You have taken a risk that we would agree with that view, but often one might say that a hearing offers a fair opportunity to test the accuracy of a statement if it offers the opportunity to use compulsory process to bring the people in. Now, if they were not locatable so that their testimony really couldn't be contested, then one might think that that opportunity was hollow. But we obviously don't know the answer to whether they're locatable. Okay.
Correct. The record is silent on that. And the government did not demonstrate any reason why they were unavailable, as is required in other circuits. There's also several problems with what occurred at the scene with the officer. The officer did nothing to corroborate the credibility of the two alleged victims. There's no criminal history checks. He failed to identify other possible witnesses who could have corroborated their statements. They were siblings, creating a potential bias. There were no sworn statements.
I'd like to go back to the first question that you addressed. Let's say that this evidence had come in at the revocation hearing not as part of the proof of one of the contested violations, but just as evidence that the court should take into consideration in deciding whether to impose the maximum of 24 months re-imprisonment.
The question would be, how did that evidence come into how was the evidence presented? In this case, it was presented through hearsay testimony.
Can you present hearsay testimony in that way for that purpose? And if so, it gets back to the question of why does any of this matter?
I would argue that you cannot, Your Honor. That
the prosecutor can't say, or the department can't say, you know, Judge, here's a reason why you should impose the maximum. This guy was arrested for beating up these two guys. Here are the facts in the police report. Put the cop on the stand. Listen to what he has to say. Take it into account in your discretion.
I would argue that would violate not only his due process right under the Fifth Amendment, but his right to confront under the Sixth Amendment. That would be unsubstantiated proffers.
But it's not
proffers.
It's not being used as in an adjudicatory way. It's being used simply as, you know, part of the universe of facts that the court should take into consideration.
Then the district court should admonish counsel for arguing facts that aren't in evidence. If you stand up and you make an assertion without any method of putting the evidence on, in other words, the hypothetical.
That's how sentencings are done in state court all the time.
Well, that's how sentencings are done several times in federal court. But again, we're talking about contested allegations that were a part of the petition to revoke.
Well, I understand that you're making that distinction, but to answer my hypothetical, you would still maintain that that's a due process violation.
Well, there's been a recent holding in this court. I would distinguish between sentencing hearings and revocation hearings.
Well, this is really more analogous to a sentencing hearing. It's to determine, since he admitted a whole bunch of other violations that were grounds for revocation, the decision that the judge was making is how much he should go away for, not so much whether there were grounds to revoke him. I mean,
the issue
clearly admitted grounds to revoke him. He was facing 24 months. He could get the 24 months on the grounds that he admitted.
Even in a sentencing hearing, hearsay, while admissible, still must be reliable. And that's how we get to the corroboration issue. All of the cases cited by the government have substantially more corroboration than this particular case. And there's at least one circuit, the Ninth Circuit, that has held that and Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Ratcliffe.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Tom Ratcliffe. I represent the United States. I I'd like to first address a couple of things that Mr. Flynn argued. He noted that that the officer did not make he alleged that the officer did not make any attempt to identify any witnesses. I'd like to note that on the police report, Edward Chronister is identified as a witness, and his address is listed, and that's in fact the address of this incident at 2726 Goodrich Avenue in Burnham. Certainly, the government acknowledges that Mr. Chronister was not called to testify, nor were the Pattersons called to testify. But because supervised release revocation proceedings and supervised release itself is fundamentally different than the criminal prosecutions which precede supervised release proceedings, the government, as established by a long line of not only cases from the Supreme Court, but cases from this court going back more than 25 years to Prelwitz v. Berg, the government does not have a burden to show good cause for why they did not bring in, why they did not call the hearsay declarants. And in fact, line of cases starting with Prelwitz, continuing through Ingerstaffer and going up through Pratt, and then most recently last year Salinas, demonstrates that even allegations, simple allegations in supervised release revocation reports, not live testimony, but those simple allegations, this court has held that that is enough for the district court to rely on, that there need not be any showing of good cause, there need not be an explicit finding that the allegations were sufficiently reliable or bore sufficient indices of trustworthiness. But as recently as last year, and I would like to note also that Salinas was decided 7 weeks after Crawford v. Washington, and certainly if Crawford changed the landscape as the as Mr. Flynn argues, then Salinas would have presumably been analyzed differently in this case. But the period of supervised release, and this case I believe turns on this, the period of supervised release is fundamentally different than a criminal proceeding. It is a breach of supervised release is really a breach of trust that the district court and the probation office have placed in a defendant.
I don't think you have to argue this at length. If it were a criminal proceeding, proof would have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant would be entitled to a jury trial and so on. So it's not, revocation of supervised release is not a criminal proceeding. The Sixth Amendment, therefore, does not apply. It's either all or none. Either everything in the Sixth Amendment applies to supervised release or nothing in the Sixth Amendment applies to supervised release.
Judge Easterbrook, I agree with you. That my point is that fundamental difference between supervised release and criminal prosecutions, I think, has a ripple effect throughout this case in that it not only addresses, as you've just described, the Sixth Amendment issue, but it addresses the Fifth Amendment due process issue, and it addresses the issue of the court's discretion to, as you all were discussing with Mr. Flynn before, to impose the maximum advisory or the maximum allowable penalty on the defendant, in this case 24 months, the maximum authorized by the statute. Because supervised release is a violation of trust, because the district court has broad discretion, they can then go in there and under Marvin and under Salinas, the district court can aggregate minor multiple violations and come up with not only a sentence at the maximum, but a sentence that the district court did not give a warning to the defendant, for example, at the beginning of the hearing, that he or she would receive the maximum. The court certainly has that discretion, and that's what, in part, Judge Moody did in this case, which was to find, not only because of the grade A violations that we believe were established, but because of the two grade B violations and then five grade C violations, that the defendant was eligible to receive the maximum, which was 24 months, which was was simply 6 months more than the 18 months that he would have received had he committed only one grade B violation. But in this case, even wiping aside the things to which Officer Morency testified about, there are two admitted grade B violations and five admitted grade C violations. And certainly Judge Moody was within his discretion to add those things together and come up with a 24-month sentence in this case, which he did. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I'd like to conclude by noting that, as I indicated before, it's the government's position that because of the fundamental difference between supervised release and criminal prosecutions, all the issues in this case come down in favor of the government, we believe, and we ask that the district court's decision and sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ratcliffe. Anything further, Mr. Flynn?
Yes, Your Honor.
2 points. One, I would refer the court to the Ninth Circuit case, which talks about the importance of the importance of the hearsay evidence is very important to determining the level of the right of confrontation. And the hearsay evidence in this case was essential. Second, with regard to whether a supervised release proceeding should be considered a so-called criminal proceeding, the defense would assert that that is a narrow reading of the Constitution. Also, I would take issue with the fact
that... The position I was making was that if something is a criminal proceeding for purposes of confrontation, it's a criminal proceeding for the purpose of the Sixth Amendment, period. That's the only way it can get to be. And therefore, the defendant gets a right to a jury trial, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the rest of it, none of which you're arguing for, none of which is required. I mean, the law is very firmly against you. I don't see any basis, maybe you have an argument, but I don't see any basis how something could be a criminal proceeding for purposes of the confrontation clause in the Sixth Amendment, but not for the purpose of the rest of the Sixth Amendment. Is there any way in which that could be so?
Your Honor, my time is up, but I will respond. I believe that that just like with due process, there's varying levels of due process. Certainly one could argue that there could be varying levels of confrontation within the Sixth Amendment.
You're not getting my question. Not varying levels of confrontation. The question is, can a proceeding be a criminal proceeding for purposes of the Confrontation Clause and not a criminal proceeding for purposes of the rest of the Sixth Amendment? There's just one phrase. It says criminal proceeding.
I would argue yes.
And how? Any case authority in your proposition?
I would refer, quite frankly, to the Constitution. The Founding Fathers, when they thought of a criminal case, they thought of deprivation of liberty. And I would assert that the Founding Fathers, if they knew a man's...
your position,
okay.
Which is
thank
no
you.
Cases. Thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.